Good afternoon. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, February 8th. We have a public hearing scheduled on four different bills. That's the total of our agenda. I'm going to start with roll call, please.
Representative Hernandez?
Absent.
Representative Levy?
Here by video.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh here by video.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith is here by video.
Vice Chair Pham? Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Present by video. I did not hear Rep. Pham.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? Is my audio working?
We see you. We will count you as present, but if you have a if you have a question or a comment, I hope that we can clear up the audio issue. I heard something very faintly. It may be a question of volume, not you're not muted. It's not showing as muted right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, at this time, we're ready to start on our agenda. I will take the bills in the order in which they're printed on the agenda. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2128. Mr. Alanak.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So this is the first of four DOR bills that you'll be hearing today, and Kate Harger from our office will be handling each of them. So she has a brief description.
Thank you, Chris. And for the record, I'm Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. I have descriptions for each of these bills that should be available under meeting materials with the bill for today. And it's in the form of a staff measure summary. So I'll briefly read a description of the bill off of that. But just in case anyone's calling in by phone or listening, I wanted to make that clear. So House Bill 2128, like Chris mentioned, is a DOR bill, and it establishes reporting requirements for tax professionals to the Department of Revenue in the event of an identity theft type breach. So current Oregon law requires they notify the consumer, but I think the department is concerned that without notification to the department, they could receive fraudulent returns. Bill, there are reporting requirements from the tax professionals to the Department of Revenue, and it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2022, and takes effect 91 days following.
Excuse me, Ms. Harger, would you please repeat the year when it takes effect? That's when there was a bit of an audio problem.
Of course, Chair Nathanson, sorry about that. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2022, and it takes effect 91 days following adjournment, any day.
Thank you. Committee, are there any questions for LRO before we start our public testimony? You'll get another chance later. It's not your last chance. Okay. We have two people signed up to testify on House Bill 2128. LRO, were there any other people signed up to testify after this list was printed? Probably not.
I'm giving Manny a minute.
Yeah.
As of just a couple minutes before.
Oh, I have the answer in front of me now. The answer is no. Okay, just two people. We can take them in whatever you would like to, whatever order you would like. Marjorie Taylor and Megan Dennison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, the Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue. As has been described, House Bill 2128 is part of the agency bill package this session. And the department has tools in place to help identify potentially fraudulent tax returns. But we've identified another tool that would be helpful to us to combat fraud. So this bill requires tax professionals to notify the department within 5 days of discovering a breach of security and provide names, addresses, and tax ID numbers of potentially impacted taxpayers. The department would then flag those taxpayer accounts for possible fraudulent activities and continue to monitor those accounts. With me today, I have Megan Dennison, who can speak to compliance issues within the agency. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Megan Dennison, Compliance Section Manager for the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2128 is the department's concept for another tool in our toolbox to combat personal income tax fraud. The bill requires tax professionals, such as licensed tax preparers and consultants, certified public accountants, and attorneys, to notify the Department of Revenue within 5 days of discovering a breach of security and provide names, addresses, and tax identification numbers of impacted taxpayers. The department will flag those taxpayers' accounts for identity theft. The number of breaches of tax practitioners has been increasing each year as fraudsters discover that the best data to use when filing a tax return is the taxpayer's own data, usually with small changes to increase a refund and, of course, to redirect the refund to the fraudster's bank account. Because these returns look so authentic, they are difficult to detect and the fraudulent refunds are nearly impossible to recover. Time is of the essence in these situations. Last year, we detected 4 breaches of tax professionals representing over 2,300 taxpayers. In all 4 cases, when we contacted the tax professional, they already knew of the breach and were working with the IRS. We discovered 1 breach 6 days after it happened and did not lose any refunds. The other 3 breaches were discovered by the department between 28 and 36 days after the breach, and we lost over $70,000 in refunds. We've received feedback that in cases of ransomware, a tax professional may not have access to their data in order to meet the 5-day reporting requirement. We are working on an amendment to provide exceptions to the 5-day data reporting requirement. However, we feel it is important that the breach itself still be reported to the department within 5 days so we can take some proactive steps to be ready to act when we receive the data. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you share with us what the DEX Act is? Does that mean they need to email? Is there a hotline that they're going to call? How are they going to make sure that the information gets to the right entity or person?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, in cases in the past, what we have done is a few different things. We have either asked the practitioner to send us a password-protected PDF with their client data in it. We've also allowed them to fax that data to us. Our staff right now are not in the office, so a password-protected PDF at this point, while we still have staff away from the office, would be preferred. But we have various methods, and then if this bill were to pass, then we would provide data to the practitioners through numerous sources with instructions of how to contact us.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, that last statement is what I was trying to get at, was how do we make this easy and accessible for the tax practitioners so they're not calling a 1-800 number ending up in a voicemail box somewhere when dollars are on the line. And so the assurance that there'll be a process set up, that an education instrument will be instituted and there'll be a streamlined method to report is really pleasing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor and Ms. Dennison, thank you for this bill. I reached out to a few of my CPA friends when I read it, just to see what their thoughts were. And one of them you've already addressed, which is the ransomware. If a hacker takes control of their computer, they may not have the 5 days to get that information to DOR. So I appreciate you working on an amendment concerning that. A couple other questions I have is, how does this bill align with other Oregon statutes that require personal information to be reported to, say, the Attorney General? And I'm assuming that tax returns, I'm just trying to figure out, are there other laws that already cover this? Are we duplicating things? If you could maybe explain a little bit more.
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, the definitions in this bill of data breach are the same that are used in other statutes, including 646A, which is the consumer protection statute. There are different reporting requirements. The reporting requirements in the consumer protection statutes are generally geared toward notifying the person whose identity was stolen that that information has occurred. There isn't anything in that statute that requires the practitioner to report it to the Department of Revenue.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure.
Thank you. So I didn't catch the ORS. What was that? What was the ORS on that, Ms. Dennison?
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, I believe it's in 646A.
Okay. All right. And then just real quickly, so again, what I'm trying to, what Representative Smith is kind of, his question is where I'm trying to go to is, I don't want them to have to report to Department of Revenue and also to report to the Attorney General. If they're already reporting to DOJ, Department of Justice, then maybe they should pass the information along. I'm just, again, I'm trying to make it easy, because when there is a data breach, there's a lot of stress. And I know these practitioners want to do the right thing by that. I just don't want to have a heavy hand by Department of Revenue on them, as well as other requirements. So I guess I'm just asking for some sort of way to make sure that there's like one place they have to report, one set of information they have to give, rather than having to go to different departments within state agencies.
Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, we can work on that.
That'd be great. I'd be more than happy to work with you on it. Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a logistical question here. So when you hear from a tax preparer or CPA, you will put a flag on the account. When does a flag come down? So the question is, does a flag at some point, perhaps the period of risk is finished, but how do we know when that is, so that a flag on an account doesn't become just a barrier to the taxpayer at some point?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. At this point, we obviously don't talk publicly a lot about our flags and some of our rules for fraud prevention. I'd be happy to, with Ms. Taylor, talk to you offline about that.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the sensitivity of it. Obviously, we need to keep the important things confidential, but I'm assuming at some point a flag comes down. Can you answer that?
Chair Nathanson, Representative March, at this time, we have the ability to remove a flag, and I'd be happy to talk with you further about that.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Any other questions or comments from the committee on this particular bill? I want to share with you a story very briefly. I was the victim of identity theft a few years ago, and I testified to a committee in the legislature shortly after it happened, because this all occurred in late December, early January, right before a session of the Legislative Assembly was to convene. And it wasn't fun at all. It was pretty scary. I received a letter from the Social Security Administration asking me to sign a piece of paper so that they could ask for information from my personal doctor before they would, basically they were going to be setting up a process to start sending my disability benefits directly to a debit card. And someone had gotten a bunch of very sensitive information, personal, signed up a new account for me with the Social Security Administration, and had already sent in instructions for defrauding the government of a lot of money under my name, and sending it to a debit card at a totally anonymous place. So it was a pretty shocking experience, and I'm actually still aware of the consequences of that, because there is now a long last, I have put a long lasting lock on my credit reports, so that no one can be applying for loans, for example, or a mortgage under my name. There were police reports filed. I continue to be very dismayed and shocked at how much criminal activity there is in the area of identity theft, consumers are being defrauded, and governments as well. I know there was some kind of a breach that affected a lot of individuals in the state of Washington. Was it in 2020 or 2019? That was another really big story. So I appreciate that DOR is working on this. I am assuming that the tax practitioners have received notice of this work proceeding in this bill. We don't have anyone signed up to testify today, so I hope that means that a lot of the details have already been ironed out, so that we can be working hand in hand, the state with the private sector, on protecting the consumers as well as the state agencies. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might make a comment real quick.
Sure.
Thank you. So I find this bill to be important in concept. I really, like you were saying, I think data security is going to be one of the top things that this legislature is going to have to deal with in the next 10 years. And we're going to have to pass laws and policies to ensure whether it's your healthcare information, whether it's your banking information, whether it's tax return information, all that, I think, is going to be challenging. So I appreciate this this bill coming forward. Again, my questions are just to making it as easy as possible for the tax preparer. Because most likely these data breaches aren't going to happen in August. They'll happen on April 1st or late March or something like that, right in the height of tax preparation. So just wanted to get that on the record that I'm a fan of the bill, just want to kind of tighten it up to make it easier for tax preparers.
Thank you, Representative Reschke. Ms. Harger, we will be expecting to see an amendment addressing the issue of ransomware or other types of situations preventing timely compliance because of a situation outside of the control of the person who is obligated to report. We will be expecting that kind of an amendment. I don't know whether there might be other amendments that might be contemplated. but you will be initiating work with the department, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, if that's what you'd like, we can absolutely do that. I'll make a note of that right now.
Yes. Yes, thank you. So I have one additional question for the agency. And you may not know the answer to this. I am noting it's very important for you to be able to be transparent with us when you can be, but basically to keep secrets when you need to keep secrets on what your technology is, for example, in your response to Representative Marsh, for example. I'm keenly aware of that position you're in, but can you tell us generally, is the agency looking into anything like blockchain technology, such as just about the entire country of Estonia uses to protect transactions? Are you looking toward the future of using other technologies to guard against this type of thing?
Chair Nathanson, I believe I might even have watched the TED Talk that maybe you learned about the blockchain technology from Estonia, which was very interesting. I'm not currently aware of us looking into that, but we can check with our friends and be sure and get back to you.
Thank you very much. Committee, any other comments or questions on House Bill 2128? And Mr. Allenack, there's no one else signed up to testify as far as I'm aware. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2128. I'm opening a hearing on House Bill 2129.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So on a lighter note than before, House Bill 2129 deals with Oregon's charitable checkoff program. This is a program that allows tax returns essentially to be applied to charities via an additional form. I believe the Department of Revenue's testimony includes a list of the 29 charities that are currently involved with this program. The goal of this bill is to change statute to update statute to reflect the current operations of the program. So it does things like reflects the current meeting schedule of the committee that chairs the program. It talks about eligibility requirements and the timing of applications that are due. So I've outlined all of those details in the staff measure summary that's present on OLIS. Additionally, it repeals obsolete statutes that no longer reflect what the program is doing. It also removes the minimum requirement for donations, and it clarifies that government entities that are set up through this program do not have to receive revenue outside of the donations received from this program. It takes effect or applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2021, and it takes effect 91 days following adjournment signing day. And I, of course, can answer any questions, and I believe the department is here to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Harger before we move to public testimony? I'm not seeing any. House Bill 2129, again, two people signed up to testify. In whatever order you like, Marjorie Taylor, Megan Dennison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue. And as you've heard from Kate, the Charitable Checkoff Commission and Program were originally created more than 30 years ago, and taxpayers can donate all or a portion of their income tax refund to any or all of the 29 charities that, as Kate acknowledged, are on our written testimony is submitted to the record. This program has grown, and we've identified some changes that would be helpful in statute. And Megan Dennison is with me, as she is the advisor to the commission and can explain all of the work that goes on with that group. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Megan Dennison, Compliance Section Manager for the Department of Revenue and advisor to the Charitable Checkoff Commission. House Bill 2129 is the department's concept to update the Charitable Checkoff Commission statutes to match form and function changes that have been made over the last 30 years since the program's inception and align to changes in the legislative process moving from biennial sessions to annual sessions. The Charitable Checkoff Program provides an avenue for taxpayers to donate all or a portion of their personal income tax refund to one or many of the 29 charities that are listed on the personal income tax return. These 29 charities either petition the commission or are approved by the legislature to receive donations. Charities that petition the commission must meet several requirements to be added to the return, such as being a 501c3 organization, having over $1 million in gross receipts in the prior year, and collecting 10,000 signatures from registered Oregon voters. Once approved, charities report to the commission every other year on how they've utilized their donations and recertify to the commission every 6 years. The commission is composed of 5 voting members of the public appointed by the governor, as well as 2 non-voting members, a representative appointed by the Speaker of the House, currently Chair Nathanson, and a senator appointed by the President of the Senate, currently Senator Burdick. Last year, charities received over 100,000 contributions totaling more than $2.5 million. On a personal note, the day of the Charitable Checkoff Commission annual meeting is my favorite day of the year. It is so inspiring to hear how these charities are using their donations all over the state to improve the lives of Oregonians. House Bill 2129 makes several changes to the Charitable Checkoff Program to bring us in line with current practices, such as clarifying the role of the Charitable Checkoff Commission and its members, updating the meeting frequency of the Charitable Checkoff Commission from every other year to every year, clarifying language around charities requalifying for inclusion on Form OR Donate, removing the minimum requirement for donations a charity must receive to continue to qualify for the program, clarifying governmental entities are not required to receive revenue from sources other than from Charitable Checkoff donations, removing outdated statutory language references, and repealing outdated or unneeded statutes. The voting members of the Charitable Checkoff Commission have had a chance to review and provide their feedback on these changes. The charities on the current roster have also been made aware of these changes, and I don't anticipate the charities will notice any difference in how they receive their distributions or report to the commission if these changes are approved. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this bill. Both of you, this is great. Just the question I had was around the removal of the, I think it's $1 million minimum, that requirement. Do you expect that more charities would sign up? Is that the goal of what you're trying to get, rather than just having 29, having maybe 100 in the program? Or what's the thinking behind the removal of that requirement?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, the removal of the minimum required for donations a charity must receive is it's a $25,000 minimum, and it's for the amount of donations that they receive through the Charitable Checkoff Program.
Okay. So if my charity is on the program and I don't receive $25,000 this year under current law or current rules, I might not be eligible to be on the program next year. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, it's within the last 2 years, but everything else is correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Other questions? I'll jump in just because I like numbers, and I know you do too. You mentioned that there were 100, I think you said 100,000 contributions, and you mentioned how much it totaled. How many taxpayers, and what was the distribution? Do most people want to direct to just a single charitable organization, or what's the average? People sometimes want to contribute to 2 or 3. What can you show us? Give us a little detail about how that's working.
Chair Nathanson, I would need to go back and get you some more specific information. The 100,000 contributions It could include more than one contribution per taxpayer. So if a taxpayer chose to donate to five charities, they would be counted five times. Mm-hmm. From looking at some of our reports, I have seen donations up to $1,000 to one charity. However, most donations are, you know, in the $5, $10, $25 range. We do note every other year, at least recently, we've had a kicker. And in years where there is a personal income tax kicker refund, the donations do rise greatly. So this $2.5 million was the largest amount of donations we've distributed ever.
Thank you for the additional detail. Any other questions or comments for this panel? Okay. And LRO, would you please tell me whether anyone else has signed up on 2129?
Madam Chair, I do not believe so, but Chris might have a more updated list than I do. No.
Okay. Thank you. And by the way, Ms. Dennison, you mentioned that it's one of your favorite days of the year when that commission meets. I remember very fondly one of the meetings, and it was the Oregon Coast Aquarium, I believe, that came and brought some whale teeth and a couple other objects that we passed around as they were discussing what their mission is. And it was just indeed a fun day and a lot of heartwarming stories. There's no other testimony. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2129. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2130.
All right, thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. This is House Bill 2130. This deals with the holiday that is celebrated in Washington, D.C., called Emancipation Day, which occurs annually on April 16th. Because April 16th is close to the tax filing deadline, there have been extensions made for that. So what this bill does is it establishes a due date, can be flexible around Emancipation Day for the declaration of estimated tax or estimated tax payments. So it's extending the treatment of returns to those payments in the case of this holiday interfering with the deadline. This would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2022, and it takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I believe the Department of Revenue is here to testify for this as well.
Committee, any questions for Ms. Harger before we move to testimony? Okay. We have one witness signed up for this one. Marjorie Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, the legislative director for the Department of Revenue. And as Kate has described, this is, again, one of our agency concepts for the session. And Emancipation Day is that legal holiday in the District of Columbia occurring on April 16th. And the holiday affects the federal tax deadline, normally April 15th, when that holiday falls on Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. The Oregon law specifies that the personal income tax returns must be filed corresponding with the federal return deadline. However, the law does not provide a similar linkage for making estimated payments that are due on April 15th, so causing the discrepancy in dates. A person's income tax filing for the previous year may be due as late as April 18th because of Emancipation Day, but their estimated tax payments for the current year would still be due on April 15th. So this affects taxpayers that apply their current year refund to their next year's estimated tax payment, making their payment late. By making the statutory change in House Bill 2130, if the previous year's tax filing deadline is modified because of Emancipation Day, then the estimated payment date is synchronized with that date. We hope that this clarifies for taxpayers the due dates for, again, their current filing and estimated payments, and it's a matter of streamlining. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
LRO, anyone else signed up to testify on this one?
I do not believe so, Madam Chair.
Okay. Committee, any questions for Ms. Taylor or comments? Anything else on this bill at all? I'm getting ready to close the public hearing. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2130. Our final bill, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2131.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2131 deals with collections for the Department of Revenue, specifically in the following areas. So we have heavy equipment rental taxes, state lodging taxes, emergency communication system taxes, and petroleum load fees. And in general, I think the department is trying to correct a problem where they have trouble collecting debt and they only have a few options left. And so in this bill, it specifies the timing of things like the notice of liabilities, assessment cases, assessment payments, appeals. And it also allows, it adds to statute a list of parties that the department can hold accountable for the debt related to taxes, including owners, officers, employees, or members. It also allows for joint and several liability of accountable parties for payment of the taxes, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2022. Sorry, let me be clear there, because I think some of this is fees. It applies to amounts due on January 1, after January 1, 2022. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signee die. And I believe that, again, the Department of Revenue is available to testify as well, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Without knowing the particulars of this bill yet, in concept, I'm strongly, strongly supportive. This is a major issue for local government, particularly, let's say, the lodging tax, where, you know, if let's say you're Baker City and you're reliant on I-84 commutes and stayovers, and if you get one or two of the hotel owners not making their payments, it has a ripple effect throughout the entire county budget. And this has been an ongoing issue within the Department of Revenue of how do you enhance those collections, knowing the impact it has on things that many of us would view as a priority. The one other thing that will be intriguing to me is on that joint and several clause, business owners better think twice about who they partner with, knowing that with that language in there that if you're part of a project or part of a business and your business partner doesn't fulfill their obligation, that you could be liable. And so I'm going to dig into this bill a little more, but concept, I think it's very needed. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Ms. Harger before we move to public testimony? Okay, I have two people signed up for this bill, Marjorie Taylor and Exanne Culver. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Marjorie Taylor, Legislative Director for the Department of Revenue, and this is our last House bill in our package for the session. And House Bill 2131, again, as has been described, some businesses and employers collect taxes paid by customers or are withheld from their employees. And those businesses and employers hold those taxes in trust until they're paid to the department. When these taxes are held in trust but not properly reported or remitted to the department, then we have limited options to collect that debt. However, House Bill 2131 adds some statutory tools that will allow the department to collect that debt for four programs and require that to hold those funds in trust. And Xanne Culver is with me, who can explain more about those programs and our trust fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Marjorie. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I am Xanne Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Marjorie said, the department does administer several tax and fee programs where the tax or the fee is imposed on the business's customer, but required to be collected by the business and then remitted to the department. The business is required to hold that tax that they collect from their customers in trust for the state until payment is made to the department. When businesses do not comply with the reporting and remittance of those taxes collected from their customers, and they do not enter into a payment plan agreement with the department does begin collection activity. And collecting those delinquent taxes from a business can be challenging because garnishment of wages is not an option. We do garnish bank accounts when possible, and it gets to that point. For the two tax programs where the tax is held in trust by a business on behalf of the state that we currently do have this authority, the withholding of personal income taxes and the marijuana retail tax, the department can hold the officers, employees, or members of the business personally liable if the department has determined that that officer, employee, or member of the business has had responsibility for reporting and remitting the tax, or the decision-making authority regarding remittance of the tax funds, but they chose not to remit the funds that they are holding in trust. House Bill 2131 extends that same authority that we have for the payroll, the withholding of personal income taxes and the marijuana tax. It would give us that same authority for the heavy equipment rental tax, the state transient lodging tax, emergency communications or E911 tax, and the petroleum load fee. All of these taxes and the fee are required to be collected by a business from their customer and then reported and remitted to the department on a quarterly basis. Determination of which persons could be held personally liable for the delinquent tax that is owed by the business requires an investigation by the department. We engage with persons that are identified as potentially having responsibility or decision-making authority for the business, and then evaluate the level of decision-making authority that person has for the business, as well as their operational responsibilities, to determine whether or not they should be held personally responsible for the unpaid tax. We assign the liability judiciously and after a thorough investigation. A person who we determine should be personally liable for the debt of the business may appeal our determination to the department or the Oregon Tax Court. So there's two pieces to it. They can appeal to us first. If they are not satisfied with that resolution, then they may appeal to the Oregon Tax Court. The revenue from these tax and fee programs is it goes to programs that are administered by other state agencies and local taxing districts. The heavy equipment rental tax revenue is distributed to county tax collectors to be distributed with property tax revenues to those local taxing districts. So it replaces the exemption for property tax. There's a specific exemption in the heavy equipment rental tax. The lodging tax revenue is distributed to Travel Oregon for various tours and promotion programs, including a direct distribution to the region in which the tax was collected. And then the E911 tax revenue is distributed to the Office of Emergency Management for funding the 911 centers across the state. And the petroleum load fee revenue is distributed to Department of Environmental Quality and the State Fire Marshal for oil, hazardous material, and hazardous substance emergency response programs responding to incidents on public highways, roads, streets, and roadside rest areas.
Ms. Culver, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. I don't know how much more you might have in your presentation, but Representative Smith has a question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't mean to interrupt the conversation. A question for our special guests here. Couldn't one argue that because the money is held in trust, it's other people's money, and failure to pay that not only constitutes a breach with the Department of Revenue, but also constitutes theft?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Smith, we could look into that with the assistance of the Department of Justice. We are aware of a provision in statute. It's in Chapter 60, which holds members of a corporation. They're essentially responsible for holding up their duties, and there could be an avenue of pursuing a judicial action outside of this collection tool.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really think we need to look into this further, because the more I think about this as a consumer, when I pay a tax and it's held by a business in trust to be paid for a specific purpose that the legislature has set out, when that business owner fails to do that, they have effectively stolen money that came from that consumer for that dedicated purpose. And so I'm in no way an attorney, but I can make a logical tie to that. And I strongly support making sure that we create a level playing field for everyone. This isn't an issue of whether to tax or not. This is an issue of, is it fair for the businesses that are complying versus those who are not? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Ms. Culver, you can go ahead with your presentation, and then we're going to follow up on that when you're done.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. As of today, we have about $900,000 owed in delinquent tax for these four programs that has been assessed, but it remains uncollectible. With the authority to assert personal liability against an owner, officer, employee, or member of a business that is responsible for remitting that tax, we, in the future, because this would apply to those taxes due on or after January 1 of 2022, and in the future, it would give us the ability to recover some of those funds from individuals that choose not to remit that tax to us and then be able to distribute it to those receiving agencies. Right now, as Representative Smith had mentioned in regards to local lodging taxes, the Department of Revenue does have authority to collect those local lodging taxes, and for those local governments who wish to enter into agreement for that activity, this additional provision would carry through as well. And that concludes my remarks, and we're happy to answer further questions.
Thank you, committee. Yes, Representative Marsh. Oh, Representative Marsh, the mute button.
Gotcha. Thank you, Chair. This is interesting timing to me because tomorrow, just to forecast a little bit of what we're going to be talking about, I have a bill that would require overnight accommodations to clearly indicate the tax that is being paid by the consumer on that bill. And I'm wondering if the other entities that are affected by this legislation have such a requirement. It's just another way to be clear that the tax has been charged and paid.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? I see Ms. Taylor probably writing some notes. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned $900,000 uncollected. Is that each year? Is that per biennium? Is that over the last 10 years?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Rep. Rushke. The $900,000 is the amount that is owed currently. I don't have a breakdown for the years, but I would be happy to get that for you.
Okay, I know the new heavy, Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Sure.
Thank you. I know that the new heavy equipment tax is something that's new in the last year or two. And so I'm just wondering between the four taxes, is there one that's worse than the others as far as non-payment? But just kind of trying to understand the revenue lost. So thank you.
Ms. Harger, who has been taking notes also, I see, I would be really interested in whatever information you could find for us working with the department on the distribution of those taxes owed that Representative Rushke was asking about, you know, overtime and assigned to which kind of tax or fee. But I'm also very interested in the issue that Representative Smith raised. My two points are going to be, Ms. Harger, will you please work with the Department of Revenue on finding a response for us, whether Department of Justice has looked into this, whether they're involved? Does this involve the possibility of criminal prosecution, some other kind of reporting, some other sort of follow-up? I'm also wondering if this is related at all to some work. This dates back several years, but there's an interagency task force that was envisioned. I don't know if it's still operating, but it had to do with sharing information between agencies, for example, employment and revenue, and there were another couple of big ones where if an entity was trying to skirt the law and not doing one thing, they probably weren't doing something else also, and the agencies should have been able to work together to figure out, oh, they owe this money, did they owe that money as well? So it will also be interesting to me to hear what you find on whether this has been the subject of that interagency task force work. Committee, other questions or comments on House Bill 2131? And LRO, did you receive any additional requests to testify on this bill? I'm seeing a no.
I don't believe so.
Okay, I'm getting ready to close the public hearing. I'm closing the public hearing now on House Bill 2131. That completes our agenda for today. Mr. Alanak, final thoughts on these bills or anything else?
I don't think so. That does round out the DOR bills for the session. I think Marjorie mentioned that. And some of the bills, as Rep. Marsh was indicating, is a good lead into tomorrow's topic on the transient lodging tax.
Good. Committee, any other remarks before we adjourn today? Thank you all. We're adjourned.